Okay. So I want to talk about functions and discretization and partial differential equations in this module. This will be a two-week module. On Mondays, I'm going to present theory, probably on a blackboard. On then Wednesdays, we're going to have lab sessions where we actually do something about get practical experience. I'm going to present the functions and discretizations a bit more mathematical than it's usually taught in more engineering-like tutorials, because this is an institute for theoretical physics. And in a two-week module, you can't learn all the recipes that exists for solving partial differential equations. So rather present some basics, and I think this mathematical language should be well suited. I'm not going to get crazy about that. So today I'm going to present functions, how to represent functions in a computer. That's called a discretization. And next week we're going to talk about differential equations and how to solve them and how to classify them. Still need to find my style. Can you read that from the back? Probably can. Very good. So the idea is, if you want to have a constructive representation of a function, something that you can touch and get your hands on and handle in a computer, then you probably best start by choosing a particular function space. For the example space that I'm going to use here is just analytic functions on the unit interval from -1 to +1. Just because that's convenient, and analytic functions because I want to here live in the fantasy that all functions are analytic anyway, since we are physicists. We're going to talk about non-analytic functions in the second half of the lecture. And the first step that you do to discretize a function is to choose a particular basis. I'm going to present the recipe here. And of course, if you choose a basis, you haven't done anything. You're still completely generic. There's no approximation involved. The second step would then be to introduce a cutoff. Basis for analytic functions would usually have infinitely many, countably infinitely many basis functions. If you introduce a cutoff, you choose a finite set of basis functions. That's the discretization, of course. Then you do your calculation, and at the end, show that things are independent of the cutoff. That, of course, is the difficult part. And the cutoff, let's call it n, independent of the choice of n. And what you typically do is you repeat your calculation multiple times for different values of n, and then you show that the result doesn't change, or doesn't change much, or that you understand how the result changes, or you make some other argument why you don't care, because the calculation might become too expensive. Discretizing functions was, to my knowledge, invented not in mathematics, but rather in engineering. So all these things have different names that you come across. For example, instead of choosing a basis, people would say they choose a discretization method. Let's call it discretization method. Instead of choosing a cutoff, people say they choose a particular resolution. And instead of showing that the results are independent of n, people speak about convergence. And convergence doesn't mean whether it converges or not. That's, of course, impossible to ascertain in a numerical setup. It's rather the rate of convergence or how fast something converges. That's much more difficult than showing than something that just that it actually converges. And I want to begin with a particular example here. So if you have analytic functions on the unit interval, there is a nice set of functions that are well known, the Legendre polynomials. And PL of x. So if you have a particular function, you can always expand it in Legendre polynomials. Write f of x equals sum over I from 0 to infinity coefficients ci times pi of x. And of course, that's always possible. You have not chosen and not made any approximation yet. So you could as well do this in Mathematica. I find myself when I discuss discretization methods with more theoretical physicists, I find myself being defensive because there's often that impression that once you discretize a function, you have an approximation and you don't know exactly how to put a handle on something. So this is kind of the where this language of me comes from. This is the representation. And of course, a cutoff, choosing a resolution, is then just replacing infinity with particular n, and then you have introduced a cutoff. And the resolution is usually given in terms of a length scale, not in terms of a certain number of coefficients. If you look at the Legendre polynomials, you see that they have maxima and minima, and Pn, the nth Legendre polynomial, has n maxima, and the distance between this maxima is given approximately by 2 over n, by the length of the domain over n. So the resolution h is given approximately by L over n. L is the length of the domain, in this case 2, and n is the number of coefficients that you choose. And now we know as n goes to infinity, this converges to the real solution. But the question is, how fast does it converge? That is, for a particular ansatz, for a particular function, how many n do you need? And I want to give an example here. And the example function is some kind of Gaussian. Might look like that. And might have a length L, that half width, whatever. It doesn't matter whether you L choose half the width or the full width. That doesn't really matter. And then it turns out you need to resolve this length scale L. So you need to resolve H, that to be approximately L, and H, and if you solve that, then you get n needs, what L need, h needs to be less than, then n needs to be larger than approximately L over L in order for this function, for this representation to make sense. In particular, if you do not have enough basis functions to represent the function, then you will have a large error. The relative error will be of order unity, an error of order 1. That means the approximation is completely useless. And as you increase n, the number of basis functions that you choose, then the error will go down. And for analytic functions, and on this particular domain, and for the Legendre functions, the error will decrease exponentially. And a plot that you might often see will look approximately like this. So I want to plot the error versus the number of basis functions that you choose. Okay, sorry, I forgot to introduce something earlier. I'm choosing the Legendre function and this particular domain. I also need to choose a particular norm on that function space to find out how the error is defined. And the norm, of course, is nothing special, just the usual. F of x, this is the norm of x that I'm using. And if I have a norm and then I have an approximation for a function and the actual function, I can calculate the norm of the difference, and that is then the error that is introduced. That's some kind of true norm. And the log of the error, if the error is 1, the log is 0. If the error is very small, then the log goes to minus infinity. So a very good approximation will have an error that is down here, and a bad approximation will have an error that is above here. And that particular point, L over L, that is introduced here, that is kind of the minimum resolution that one guesses is about here. And if this is 0, then the error will be approximately here. And it will stay approximate, the error will stay approximately 1. And here, the error will begin to decrease, going towards minus infinity. And this region here is called the convergence regime. If you have enough resolution, then by changing the number of collocation points, the number of basis functions, you can choose the error that you're making. And obviously, if you choose more basis function than representation, the calculation becomes more expensive, often prohibitively so, but the error decreases. And these days, if you have an optimized setup, then one of our symmetry compute nodes could hold, I don't know, a billion basis coefficients or something. So quite large numbers. But of course, that is also expensive to actually do calculations like that. And the real function, of course, does not actually look like that. It would be much more jagged and have step functions in there, and so on and so forth. And of course, the cutoff is not exactly at L over L. It's approximately there. But this is a exponential falloff. That means, for example, if you add three more basis functions, the error will reduce by a factor of 2. So if you want to reduce the error by a factor of 1,000, then you just add 30 more basis functions. 2 to the 10 is then a factor of 1,000. And you can get the error as small as possible. In reality, that, of course, doesn't continue down here, because there is a thing called floating point accuracy. If you use double precision, then you have about 16 digits of precision. So here, at 10 to the minus 16, the error will then bottom out. And the discretization is much more exact by that. At that point, but your representation of the real numbers then becomes inaccurate, because in a computational setup, if you want to actually compute something, then you need to bound to use an approximation such as floating point numbers, because the real numbers are useless in that context. And what we are going to do on Wednesday is we're going to use a discretization method. And we're going to play with functions and represent them. And the next week, going to use that basic setup to solve partial differential equations. This is the one example for Legendre functions. Wonder what I should do next. Yes. Next, I want to show how to calculate a derivative of a function, or do you want to learn integration first? Let's talk about integration first, because integration is actually easier in a setup. Let's assume you want to solve a definite integral. You want to integrate a function over this domain. And that is called quadrature. Quadrature are definite integrals. They can be evaluated conveniently and very accurately. And if you represent a function, then of course you're also interested into finding out what the error is that you have. And the error is defined by a norm like this, and the norm contains an integral. So it totally makes sense to be able to evaluate that integral numerically. And No, I think I'm skipping ahead. Sorry, a bit confused here. I think I want to talk about differentiation first, about derivatives. Assume you have given a function f of x, and you have a discrete model of that function. You have the basis coefficients. Then one thing you might want to do is calculate the derivative of the function. Obviously, if you want to solve a differential equation, that's an important step. So if you have f of x given, let's use that example over there, as an integral, as a sum, ci dI of x, then you can easily calculate the derivative. F prime of x is then, sum goes right through, the coefficient is just a number, nothing happens. And then you have the derivative of your basis functions, here the Legendre functions. And that's inconvenient because you don't want to represent functions in terms of derivatives of the Legendre functions. You want to represent functions in your old basis functions again. So then you're going to write this as sum I, ci. It is well known how to express derivatives of Legendre functions again in terms of Legendre functions. There's a set of coefficients you're getting. So this is then going to be some sum over j. I don't know. I don't want to write down the coefficients. This is just d I j d j of x. So the derivative of the ith Legendre function is just some linear combination of other Legendre function, again with the sum over j here. If I'm going too fast or if I'm too theoretical, please stop me. And if I leave out the various sums and use abstract index notation, then this is d j I z I dj of x. And this here is just matrix vector multiplication in abstract index notation. That is, there is a matrix that explains how to take derivatives. What I did here for the first time might be a bit weird, because on one hand we're talking about functions f of x and the Legendre polynomials pi of x. And what happens here is that these functions get mapped to vectors, to linear algebra, where things are not functions anymore, but just a bunch of numbers in vectors. And that is, of course, the idea of a discretization, because computers are very good at handling these. So this ci, the coefficient of vectors, is how we represent a function. So given a function, you can project it onto Legendre polynomials. Internal representation in Julia code is then just this vector ca. It's just one long array of numbers, how that function is represented. And correspondingly, if you have all these coefficients, you can evaluate that function at any point that you want. For example, if you want to plot it, or if you want to export it, show it to someone else. And if you want to take a derivative of a function, then given such a vector c, and knowing that the function is represented in Legendre polynomials, you can multiply that vector by a matrix D, and that matrix D is uniquely specified by the basis. It does not depend on x or on the coefficients, and that tells you how to take a derivative. That is, a derivative which we know is a linear operator. Once you represent functions as a finite-sized vector, a derivative is just the finite-sized matrix of coefficients. This matrix, you can, I don't know, there's probably even a Wikipedia page that describes how this matrix might look like for Legendre polynomials, or you can construct it. You can find a Julia package for it. And this is an efficient way of evaluating derivatives. And solving a partial differential equation then involves handling matrices such as D. Okay, that's the first time that this happened. I now also want to describe how functions can be integrated. That is what is usually called quadrature. The name quadrature comes from the idea that if you want to evaluate a definite integral, you calculate the area under function. That's the Riemannian sum that you have there. So you're looking for various quadrilaterals that approximate the function, and hence the old name quadrature for evaluating a numerically a definite integral. There are many methods for doing that. I want to mention here only one particular method because it's convenient. This method is due to Gauss. It's called Gauss quadrature. And this method is optimal if the function is analytic. If you have non-analytic functions, there are other methods that you might want to use. And I don't want to go too much into the details for for Gauss integration. I just want to sketch the approximate idea, because this approximate idea holds for all kinds of integration that you do.
Eric, did you say Gauss? This is for, are we doing analytical or non-analytical?
This is all numerical in the end. So, yes, the only step that I have not yet explained is how you get these coefficients ci if you're given a function f on x. And at the end of quadrature, I can explain one numerical method. So, but in the end, everything will be numerical. Everything will be linear algebra. That is, you're handling vectors and matrices and getting something out, except for reconstructing the function in the end. That requires evaluating Legendre polynomials. And if you have given a random function and want to integrate it, basically the only thing you can do is evaluate the function at various points. So the question is, how, at what points do you evaluate a particular function, and how do you combine that to the integral? So if you have some, say, minus one and plus one and some function given here, then what you want to do is you want to choose a particular set of points here and evaluate the function at exactly these points. And the quadrature integral is a linear operation. Hence, the final result must be a linear combination of the function values at these points. These points are called collocation points. Sorry for introducing terminology. You can stop me if I do that, but I think in the end it might help. And yeah, you want to take a linear combination of the function values at these collocation points. That means you want to sum them up with particular weights, integration weights. And what Gauss showed is that the optimal way to choose these collocation points is to not choose an equispace grid, but have them bunch up at the outer edge of the integral, if it's a finite-sized integral, that reduces the Gibbs phenomenon. Usually, otherwise, if you have an equispace grid, the actual function that you'd reconstruct would show large oscillations there. Now, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. I want to give a sketch of one way to calculate collocation points. The exact way of calculating optimal collocation points is maybe not interesting, because in the end, you might not need the optimal way. A close to optimal way is good enough. And the exact recipe can easily be found, say, on pointers that you get on Wikipedia and so on. What you want to do is you evaluate that function here at these collocation points, and then you reconstruct, say, a Legendre polynomial, a polynomial that interpolates between these points. And once you have a polynomial and the coefficient for a polynomial, you can evaluate the area under the polynomial analytically. You have the coefficients, and then you know what the area is. If a polynomial, you can find the antiderivative and evaluate it numerically. And I lost my train of thought, sorry. Lost my train of thought here. The idea is to once you are able to evaluate via quadrature integrals like this, you can use this to calculate the coefficients for an approximation. In this example here, what one does is you take the function and project it onto the Legendre polynomials. Let me describe that. start with your basic ansatz, f of x equals abstract index notation, so I don't need the sum sign pi of x. You know that the Legendre polynomials are orthogonal, that simplifies things. We can multiply left or right with Legendre polynomials, so then you get, and then integrate, then we get integral pk of x f of x equals ci, and then the integral over pi and pk to Legendre polynomials, of course, known. I'll just write delta ij here, assuming that they're normalized. They're probably not normalized, so in real life you get another factor here. This is the integral that you then have to evaluate numerically, and then you can read off your coefficients here. This is the proper way of, if you're given a function, to actually evaluate the coefficients. In real life, people also use a shortcut for that. This shortcut is a bit more difficult to see for Legendre polynomials, so I'm going to introduce a different discretization method first. So far, I've used the Legendre polynomials as an example for discretization methods, and they have one advantage, well, several advantages. One is they're well known, they are easy to use, but the disadvantage, well, the other advantage is that they have exponential convergence, this exponential fall off. But what I maybe didn't emphasize is that this is only the case for analytic functions. And in many cases, functions are actually not analytic. In hydrodynamics, for example, you might have stars. There's the surface of a star. There's a kink in there. In other cases, you might have shocks. So you might have a domain that contains a black hole, and you might represent the singularity inside a black hole. Anyway, for non-analytic functions, spectral representations, such as with the Legendre polynomials, still converge, but they converge only linearly. That means if you want to reduce the error by a factor of 2, you don't need one or two more points, but you need twice or three times as many basis functions. And that, of course, is then rather inconvenient, because then you need not just 20, 30, 50, but thousands of collocation functions. It's much more expensive. And in this case, there are other classes of discretization methods that are more convenient to use. And I want to introduce one other class of discretization methods as well in this theoretical lecture, and then only briefly mention the names of a few other most important ones. And on Wednesday, you can then choose whether you use a spectral representation or another representation for your exercise. So the other representation instead of spectral methods is, let's say, adapted to computers. Instead of doing something very mathematically elegant with polynomials and orthogonality and so on, you do something simple and brute force, and you do it a lot of times. So in this case, the representation is piecewise linear continuous functions. We call it PLC because it's lazy to write that. So you have your domain, minus 1 to plus 1 again, and then you choose a few points here, say 5 points, equispaced, and then a particular function might look like this, consist of 4 line segments, just interpolating between these points. And if you are given a particular function that lies through there, you see the error is much larger. And in general, for a smooth function, the error is larger as you'd get if you use, say, a fourth order Legendre representation. The grid spacing here is then, the resolution h is here given by L divided by n minus 1, I guess. If you have 5 points, you have 4 line segments. So the distance between points is then L over n minus 1. And you might not be familiar with the basis functions that lead to a linear interpolation here. Let me sketch these. what I drop here. Basis functions look like hatch functions. Oh man, yeah, no, this is going to be a disaster here, sorry. So each of the basis functions looks like a triangle function. And the condition here is that each of the basis functions is piecewise linear and continuous. It has compact support. It is one at exactly one collocation point and is zero at all the other collocation points. Basis functions are piecewise linear and continuous, one at one collocation point, zero at all other collocation points. And this is exactly the right number of conditions to define the basis functions. So for example, this basis function would be zero here, then one here, going down to zero, and remain zero here. This is also called a position basis. Because it has one really nice property. If you take a collocation point, then one of the basis functions is one there. All the other basis functions are going to be zero there. That is, the basis coefficient is also the value of the function at that point. And that is, of course, a really nice property to have. If particular, if you have a nonlinear interaction, that, for example, you want to calculate the square of a function, if the function is represented in terms of a spectral basis, Legendre polynomials, then it is a really difficult operation. You need to have a folding integral to calculate that. But in a position basis, squaring a function is rather easy because you know the function value here, it's that basis coefficient. You square that basis coefficient, that's the new basis coefficient. And this is an approximation of the square of the function. So nonlinear terms are much easier evaluated in a position basis. And this is why, in practice, spectral representations for nonlinear functions are not really used. People rather switch to a pseudo-spectral representation that I might sketch later, where you have a spectral basis, but then you do a basis transformation that leads to a position basis that retains almost all of the advantages of the spectral representation for smooth analytic functions, the good convergence, but you can also evaluate nonlinear interactions. And here, for this piecewise linear functions, this comes built in.
So what was the spectral representation here?
This is not a spectral representation. I call this one a spectral representation. Spectral representation means that each of the basis coefficients kind of picks up properties of the functions all over the domain, like a Fourier transform. So in infinite domain, each of the Fourier basis functions would do that. In a finite domain, I mean, you're free to define what spectral means in that case. But I'd say for the domain minus 1 to 1, that the spectral basis functions are Legendre polynomials. You can change your norm, and then you get Chebyshev basis functions, for example. And of course, you have more complicated functions. You can have functions living on a sphere, then you get the YLM, the spherical harmonics, and so on and so forth. And I'm just giving examples here. And these basis functions have another advantage, namely they have compact support. So for a large number of these basis functions, each of these basis functions is rather small. So if you want to calculate an integral, that is much easier. You don't need to integrate over the domain. You only need to integrate over that part where the basis functions are non-zero. And of course, the basis functions just the line up, line down, so these integrals are really easily evaluated. And if you want to calculate the coefficients form a function, there's a particular approximation you can do. You can just read off the value of the function at the collocation points. It's not the proper way of doing it. That's an approximation, but it is rather easy when you just sample. So everybody does it in that respect. This basis function has one disadvantage. As you see, the basis functions overlap. Overlap is always positive. These basis functions are not orthogonal. So any kind of projection you're doing and so on becomes really expensive because in the end you need to orthogonalize, use a Gram-Schmidt or something, which but people don't like to do that. And this discretization method with piecewise linear continuous functions, the way I'm developing here, is also called finite differences. And compared to the spectral method over there, the spectral method is more the mathematical, mathy kind of way, where you care about things like orthogonality and good convergence and everything, but it only works for analytic functions. This is rather more the, I don't know, what's the name for a street dog or something? This is, nobody likes finite differences, but everybody uses finite differences. They're everywhere, they're really convenient, they don't work really well, but they don't fail spectacularly either. So if you don't know what to do, many people use these as a first method. And they're not actually bad methods, they just have a bad reputation, I guess, because many people who don't know much about discretization methods use these methods, maybe make mistakes, don't know the properties, and then you get a bad experience with that. But there exist higher order finite differences, where there, in the end, there's kind of a smooth connection between higher order finite differences and spectral methods, if you want to do that. And yes, so I talked about Gauss integration, that's the for analytic functions very well. If you have a function that is not analytic and you want to get a quick estimate, then of course you can also do an approximation by using finite differences, where you use these basis functions, you sample the function here, and then evaluate the integral using these basis functions numerically. But if you represent a function via piecewise linear continuous functions, this gives you exactly the Riemann integral, the more complicated Riemann integral where you kind of average between left and right. So there's also a natural connection between these. Okay, maybe I should just do a few minutes of show and tell and talk about what kind of discretization methods exist. This is, obviously one or two lectures are much too short to give an introduction into what is possible really, but at least there are, I think there are five classes of discretization methods. I want to at least have written them down at some point. So first, pseudo spectral. This is what I showed earlier, where you choose smooth basis functions, Legendre, Chebyshev, YLM, Fourier basis functions, and represent something like this. These work beautifully for smooth, for analytic functions, and have converge very quickly. That means you need to have only very few basis functions to get a very accurate result. So if you want a result to 16 digits or something, then the spectral method or something that you should look at. But if you actually have PDEs that come from hydrodynamics and you might have shocks or discontinuities, then it's very difficult to use super spectral methods. Next, because I already mentioned that, there are finite differences. That's just widely used. Nobody really likes them. They are not really bad. Easy to use. They're everywhere. Next, I would mention finite volumes. Here, I represent a function via piecewise linear continuous functions. You can also use something like piecewise continuous functions. Piecewise constant, and then obviously discontinuous functions, where you just say the average the function value and do something. Let me just sketch it here. Just have averages here. Break the domain into cells and have averages. And this is a good method for hydrodynamics where you have conservation laws. Instead of knowing the density in one particular location, you take the average density in one of these cells. So I'm pretty sure what you will be presented in the hydrodynamics lecture will be in some way based on finite volumes. Of course, a sketch like here is just a very coarse approximation. You can make these approximation methods much more elegant and more powerful in the end. And then there are finite elements. They're kind of all finite in the name. And finite elements have a very strong mathematical background. So if you're the kind of person who wants to write a paper about the convergence properties of your discretization method before you sit at the computer to code, then I recommend something like finite elements. There's a lot of math literature about them. If you want to solve elliptic equation, that is time independent equations, then many people use finite elements. They're also widely used in engineering. If someone was to calculate how a turbine blade looks like in a jet engine or something, that would probably be a finite element method. And they're also really good methods, so I don't know why people use finite differences for this black hole, not finite elements. I guess it's just that people know they use the same methods on and on instead of looking around. And finally, there are particle method. That doesn't mean that you track individual particles, but if you have a bunch of matter, say 10 kilograms of matter, then instead of discretizing the manifold, you can discretize the matter content. Then you have, say, 10 particles. Each particle represents 1 kilogram of fluid. These are computational particles, not atomic particles. And that would be used in hydrodynamics or in plasma physics, where you have a certain number of electrons represented by these particles, and the particles move around. The advantage of particle methods is, for example, that mass is automatically conserved. You don't need to worry about that. And also the particles are there where the matter is. If you have a large amount of vacuum in your spacetime, then no particles will be there, no computational particles. It makes things automatically very efficient. Okay, I have shown how convergence looks like for the spectral method. I should also have shown how convergence looks like for finite differences. So I'm going to sketch the same graph as this one, but for finite differences. And so here I have the log of the error, which is zero here. And since I expect a polynomial convergence, I'm going to use a log-log plot for the error. And then you have here log n. And then, of course, it's the same thing. There is this minimum resolution, L over L. And yes. The difference is this is null versus log n. That means instead of having, say, 10 more grid points, you would need to go from here to here 10 times more grid point. And the slope here of this is called the convergence rate. That is the error as a function of the spacing is then proportional to the grid spacing minus p, some kind of power, whereas over here, I hope I'm getting the minus signs right here, and that is the order of the method that you're using. Finite differences, as described above, would be a second order method. That means if you have twice as many points, the error goes down by a factor of 4. That is convenient. If you do the same thing in higher dimensions, say you're having a 3-dimensional system, and then you decrease the grid spacing by a factor of 2, the error goes down by a factor of 4, but the number of points that you have, since you have 3 dimensions, goes up by a factor of 8. That means that high dimensional calculations are very expensive because you have so many points. If you need to increase the resolution, this would be, at some point, it becomes prohibitively expensive. And oh, and a very important point I forgot to mention earlier about these discretization methods. This is just the basic classification. Everything that happens in the real world, of course, is a hybrid, a mixture of these methods. For example, if I were to design a new code from scratch to solve the Einstein equations, then a very good way would be to take a finite element code, and within each element code, within each element, things are represented in a spectral representation or in a similar manner. So this is not that each method you're encountering will be one of these methods. These are almost always mixtures of methods. And you might also be wondering why I'm spending so much time in a theoretical lecture instead of just showing you the ropes. The reason is that, good, AC is back. The reason is that before you actually should code something, I think it is important to also think about the discretization method and make sure things work, in particular if you also want to solve a partial differential equation. And the problem that many people encounter is that one has to spend a lot of time into these preliminary works before you can use a numerical method for an actual physics problem. And that, of course, is a problem in several ways. One is that at some point you might even want to write a paper about these preliminaries before you solve a physics problem, and then you need to find the right journal for it. Some physics journals might say, well, you haven't actually solved anything. You're able to solve the Schwarzschild black hole in this new method, but that's not interesting. There's no physics in it. And it's also important that you have the right mindset. Sorry if I'm preaching here, that you don't think of, oh, I spent 10 days in front of the computer to solve a particular thing. Rather, what you should think about themselves, oh, I spent one day at a blackboard doing this, designing this new method, then 10 days at the computer testing it. But that doesn't mean that the 10 days in the computer were more important than the one day thinking on a piece of paper on a blackboard. And when you talk to others, then you shouldn't say that, oh, I wrote this computer program, but rather, oh, I developed this discretization methods and I tested it with a computer program. And of course, the code is available for others to look at on a GitHub repository. Okay. Enough of that. Now, a practical way, let's assume that you have, and that will be one of the exercises on Wednesday, that I give you a function and you should discretize the function, and you also want to estimate what the error is in discretizing the function. You can go back to the Gaussian here, and let's assume we want to discretize it with finite differences, and I'm going to walk you step to the step what some kind of errors you might encounter or what your code should be doing. So let's take as an example the Gaussian again. This is the domain. Minus 1, plus 1, and let's say the Gaussian looks like this, rather narrow, and then you might choose a finite difference discretization with 5 grid points. Let me draw 5 grid points here. And then, of course, you sample the function because that is what everybody does at these 5 grid points. And then, of course, that you get basically all zeros. And next you evaluate the error, the integral, also numerically. You compare the function that you sampled with the Gaussian, but the Gaussian evaluated at these grid points. And of course, at these grid points, the two actually agree, and then you conclude that your discretization error is zero. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. So the question is, how can you bootstrap yourself? How can you test that the discretization is correct without resorting to Mathematica and taking your discrete function representation and calculating the integral symbolically, which would be way too expensive in many cases? Do you have an idea for how to address that?
Sorry, can you say that again?
What you want to do is you want to bootstrap yourself. You want to check the error in your calculation, but you don't want to resort to a symbolic calculation. Just using numerical methods, you want to estimate how good your numerical methods are.
Can you compare different solutions?
Yes, so that is what you would do. Now, in this case, if you have a Gaussian here, of course, you should know what kind of features you have in here. discretizing something without knowing how the function looks like is very difficult. So you kind of know the width of the Gaussian, and then you say, yeah, this width of the Gaussian is 1 over 10, so I'm not going to try even without fewer than 10 or 20 grid points. That's one thing. And then you can discretize the function here, then you can use the next higher resolution, and then you check how the corresponding coefficients look like, how the error looks like. And if I draw this diagram here, how the actual discretization error looks like, that's not how it really looks like. This is just the envelope. The actual discretization error is could be a jagged thing. And looks like this. So if you discover it, if you just look at it at a few points, then you can easily be fooled. So you need to look at the range of resolutions. Of course, if you do something in 3D that's really expensive, where each test takes a few hours, then that's difficult to do. But that's why you get some experience with easier one-dimensional systems where the tests can run really quickly. And if you have just something simple one-dimensional here, there's nothing that should stop you from using 1,000 or 1,000,000 points and repeating the calculation here. I think even for 1,000 points, it still takes longer to plot the result than to actually do the calculation. And if you have a reasonably well-written Julia code, then you should be able to do 1,000,000 points as well on the laptop. That's not a large number these days. And the idea is to repeat a calculation at multiple resolutions and then compare the results that you're getting. And there's a thing called Richardson extrapolation. I should be more careful when I write names. And the idea here is that you do the same calculation for multiple resolutions, for multiple numbers of basis functions. And you know the order of accuracy. That your method has, and then you assume that the largest error comes from an error term of this kind, and then you try to eliminate that error by performing multiple calculations. So let's assuming you calculate some quantity, for example, the integral over the Gaussian. And let's assume that the integral at a particular resolution n is then the true integral plus an error term that depends on the resolution plus alpha times h to the minus 2 or something, because the order of the method would be 2. What? That is not true. Yes. Hn. Because it's the resolution n. And then, of course, if you repeat it at a different resolution, you can calculate i2n, i4n, and you assume this is still the exact solution, plus alpha times h2n to the minus 2, and so on. You can repeat this a few times. Maybe you multiply n by 2. Maybe you do something else there. And then you can either solve for these quantities alpha, that is the error coefficient, and the true value, or you can fit in some way, because you know how the function looks. And in particular, I is the exact solution. You can make an estimate for the exact solution, you know, trying to estimate how things converge. This, of course, is not the true form. This is just the largest error. There's going to be another term, beta times hn to the minus 3 plus, and so on and so forth. We just assume that h is small. That means h to the minus 3 is much smaller than h to the minus 2. So we neglect this term. So this works only if the resolution is rather small. What? This doesn't make sense, right? You need to correct me if I make errors like that. Yes, yes. So embarrassing. Okay, that was a lot of theory. I'm afraid it might be a bit dry without actual exercises. And I hope that we didn't, or you didn't lose the red thread through that lecture. So I want to make sure that this didn't happen. I'm going to, repeat. The idea is that one wants to approximate a function, but wants to have a constructive representation of a function that essentially allows you to hold the function in your hand and do things with it. And that requires to approximate the function, hence a discretization. You have your function space, you choose a particular basis, then you introduce a cutoff, and of course all results of that function should be independent of the cutoff. There's a wild zoo of methods of basis functions that one can choose. There are spectral methods, which are mathematically very elegant and very accurate, but they require analytic, very smooth functions. There are other methods, such as finite differences, that don't have such requirements and maybe don't converge as fast. In a mathematical setting, it might be more interesting whether something converges or not, or to what value it converges. If you want to do a calculation, then it's also interesting how fast something converges and at a given resolution, how large the error is, hence the methods that I presented here.
Why there's not a term union in H?
Pardon?
Why there's not an error union in H?
Oh, I didn't derive that. It cancels out if you do that, because the method is kind of symmetric around every grid point. There's something on the left, something on the right, and exactly cancels out. That has to do because I choose the grid spacing to be constant. If you vary the grid spacing, then you also pick up a small error, but that depends on the grid spacing. But there are other methods that can help you get rid of that error again. Also, this is a piecewise linear representation. Of course, you can do piecewise parabolic and so on. That makes the method a bit more complicated, but in the end, the error is reduced. And these days, a second order implementation with piecewise linear is probably not the sweet spot. A fourth order method, where you have piecewise third order polynomials, is not much more difficult to implement, but the error is much reduced because the error grows like the fourth power, not the second power. So this error term here is much smaller for a given resolution. So these days, I'd probably use a fourth order method. One would probably use a fourth order method by default. Okay. I also did not show yet how to calculate derivatives with the finite differencing method. That's actually a very important point that I missed earlier. Sorry. So I'm just sketch that as well. So the basic way that functions are represented via these cone functions is the same way as for a spectral method. You have a function f of x, and it is given by a sum over some coefficients, some basis functions. I don't call it, let's just call it bi of x, where these are these triangle functions, right? There are these functions that look like these triangles that we had. Let me just number them left to right. And then the derivative is then of course given by ci bi prime of x. It's the same way I derived it for the Legendre polynomials up there. But the main difference is now if you have a derivative of a Legendre polynomial, it can be expressed in terms of other Legendre polynomials. If you have a derivative of a function like this, then the derivative looks like this. It's a constant, piecewise constant function, and it's not continuous anymore. So now if you take a derivative, then we actually fall out of our vector space. And it's quite inconvenient. And what one does is one needs to project back into the vector space. That means you need to find a piecewise linear continuous function that approximates this function. And that means if you take a derivative with a spectral representation above Legendre, you make no error because the derivative is still in the vector space. Whereas if you take a derivative with finite differences, you do make an error because the true derivative falls outside of that cut of vector space that you have, and that means you need to project back in there. And that, of course, if you look at the details, creates all sorts of headaches for derivatives. For example, if you take a derivative of a derivative, then you project twice. Whereas if you take a second derivative, then you project only once. And it's like rounding twice. That gives a slightly different result. And if I represent that function, how would that look like? I can't sketch it. Let's sketch it differently here for a particular function. So if you have a function given and you want to evaluate the derivative at this point, then there is a right derivative that is well defined and a left derivative that is well defined, given by kind of these two values here. And what one does in finite differences, well, there are three ways. You either take the right derivative, the left derivative, or the average of the two derivatives. So the most common one is the average. That's called the left, the right, and the centered derivative. And then, for example, here, the left and the right, the central derivative, and the average derivative, say, has a slope like that. And if you do this, then you can again write this in the same way as before. This gives the matrix dij ci bj of x. Oh, sorry, this is just approximate, because what I left out is the actual projection step. Now, the projection step is also a linear operator. Everything is still linear, but I didn't write it down in the mathematical way as to not be confusing, and then you still can also calculate it like this. And if you have a spectral representation, I don't know whether you remember this, but representing the derivative of a Legendre polynomial in terms of other Legendre polynomials, you pick a few lower order terms up. So the respective matrix that comes out is, I believe, an upper triangular matrix, just the matrix representation of the derivative operator for the Legendre polynomials. And here for the finite differences, the matrix representation is a very sparse matrix. It just has two non-zero off diagonals. If I take this derivative operator of finite differences and write it as in a matrix form, then you have zero on the diagonal. And then you have on the right, it's plus 1/2. Plus 1/2, and below the diagonal you have minus 1/2, minus 1/2 here, and a factor of 1 over the grid space in here that you pick up. I'm just showing you this. You can easily derive it yourself if you think about how these hat functions look like. They have a slope that goes like 1 over h, and the slope 1 over h then means that's what you pick up from the derivative. And if you average left and right, you get a factor of 1/2. And then the matrix representation in the end looks like that. I don't know whether it makes sense to derive that here, or whether it is easier to just accept it and continue the calculations. Are you interested in deriving how that matrix looks like? You seem to be okay. Yeah, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing to be a bit more explicit in how these finite differencing and how the hat functions actually look like. Because for Legendre functions, you know how they look like. Mathematica can plot them. But for the actual hat functions that I have here, then of course you have some intuition how they look like. But it's also nice to know a bit more detail there. So let's write down how these functions look like. Remember, this was the domain. And then we have these points here. and then the function is all zero, goes up and goes down again. And this function here, called it bi, so this point here is the ith point. It has coordinate xi, and xi is, I'm going to cheat, I'm going to change the domain from 0 to 1 here. Then this coordinate xi is just I over n. So you have n points here. Points start from 0 to n minus 1. I want to have n points. And the x coordinate of the ith point is I over x minus 1. And then writing down how this function looks like. Actually, let me define h as 1 over n minus 1. And this is just h times I. It's the ith grid point. There's, of course, no complex number involved here. And then we have the function is 0. X less than h times I minus 1, and it's also 0 for x larger h times I plus 1, and defining that function is exactly as straightforward and tedious as you imagine. And since the basis function is 0 here and is 1 here, and this distance is h, the slope is 1 over h. So let me write 1 over h here times x minus the zero intercept is at h times I minus 1 for h times I minus 1 less than x less than h times I. Minus 1 over h, the slope is minus that times x minus h, no, x minus h I plus 1 for h times I less than x less than h times I plus 1. And you know what? You're making me do this here. You're going to implement that on Wednesday in Julia. Anyway, in Julia, it's easy to debug that. You plot that function, and it looks like that, or it doesn't look like that. But here on the blackboard, it is just a bunch of characters. So it's very, very difficult for me to see whether it's actually correct with all the pluses and minus and h's and signs. So you can help me here correct that. And the derivative, well, calculating the derivative of that is straightforward. These constant terms drop out. And then, of course, the derivative, let me, bi prime, let me just write the derivative here. In this case, it's 0. That case here is 0 as well. The derivative here is 1 over h, and here it's minus 1 over h, which I just read off from the left-hand side here. And this is just the function that I sketched up there. Well, the derivative obviously is 0, then it's positive, then something negative, something negative, and 0 again. And now I want to take this basis function and project it back onto basis functions. Now realize that's a bit more complicated than I thought it would be. Because if I want to project this derivative onto this set of basis functions, and this set of basis functions actually not orthogonal, then it's really difficult to do that. I mean, you can write it down and then do the Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization, but I think I'm not going to do that, attempt that on a blackboard. I'm rather going to argue that the derivative, so this basis function is centered around the point I. If I want the derivative here, then I need to look at the neighboring values here, 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 and here. Let's call the, so if you have an actual function, let me draw the function then here. This is point number I. If you have a function here, then I call this yi, yi minus 1, and yi plus 1. These are just the function values, and these are actually these are just the coefficients. I shouldn't introduce a new notation for that. I called it c over there. Then the resulting function, since it uses linear interpolation, the slope here is given by ci minus 1 divided by h. This distance is h. You have the value here and here. This is the slope here. And the slope on the right-hand side is ci plus 1 minus ci divided by h. This is this slope here. And in the end, I said I want a central difference. I want to average between these. So this is then the central derivative. And if you simplify it, then the ci actually drops out. This is 1 over 2h ci plus 1 minus ci minus 1. And this is the index notation. If you spread out the index notation into a big matrix, into one row of the matrix, then this is kind of row I. Column I, then the ci has the coefficient 0, ci minus 1, let me pull out the 1 over h terms here, it's minus 1 half plus 1 half, and everything else is 0. So the matrix representation of this is a 0 along the diagonal, and left of the diagonal minus 1 half. Right of the diagonal plus 1 half. The 1 half comes from the averaging of the two derivatives, and the 1 over h factor, just pull out, comes for the grid spacing. And this is also why it's called finite differencing. You calculate the value at this point, you look at the left value, and you look at the right value. You ignore everything in between, because in the beginning you probably just sampled the function, and then you have a finite difference instead of the infinite difference in the limit f of x plus h divided by h that you get from the definition of the derivative. Okay, I didn't plan this part of the lecture. That's probably a bit confusing. Apologies, I'm going to make it implement you on Wednesday just to make it work. And what I also wanted to repeat is how to integrate a function, because this is what you need to calculate an error for finite differences. You have all the basis coefficients, and then to evaluate the integral like this, you have n basis coefficients, and each of these basis coefficients needs to have a particular weight if you want to have if you want to evaluate the integral. And maybe I shouldn't overload the figure here. You can, maybe I should actually get the blackboard down again. This is now quadrature with finite differences. If a function given here and you have a few points, and you know the function values here. And to calculate the integral of the approximate function that you're given, you remember how the basis functions looks like. For example, this coefficient here, which is z0, is a basis function that looks like that. And the integral is this value here. You also know that this is h. And then you know that the area under the basis function is 1 over 2h. So the integral over this function here is 1 over, let me pull out the 1 over h factor. Okay, z bar, 1 half z naught plus c1. That basis function looks like this. And what's the integral over this basis function? So integral is linear. So if a function has a linear superposition of basis functions, then we can just sum up all the integrals over the basis functions due to linearity. We don't need to calculate any interactions. So the function value here is c1. And then what is the area that horizontal triangle? It's just, yes, it's times 1 half, the base times the height. The height is c1, the base is 2h, so it's plus h, c1. And of course, you see the pattern. Here on the left, you pick up a factor 1 half because this basis function is kind of cut off. All the other basis functions look exactly like that. Plus h, cn minus 2 plus 1. Load a factor of h. I hope you're correcting me before you do that. Plus 1 half c n minus 1. And that's just my numbering because n minus 1 is the last one here. C4. Could have just have called it c4. And then the sum of all the weights is exactly. The sum of all the weights, so we have n minus 1 weights. So the sum is, actually we have n weights from 0 to n minus 1, but two of the weights are only 1 half. So the sum of all the, let me call these weights w. Sorry for introducing another notation. The sum of all the weights is h times n minus 1. And h is defined over there as L over n minus 1 times n minus 1, which is exactly the volume of the simulation domain. Sorry, of the domain, which is exactly what you expect. If you sum up all the weights, that's the same as integrating a function that is constant 1 everywhere, and then you should get the volume of the domain. That's an important cross-check if you calculate your integration weights. So integrating a function is actually surprisingly easy. You have all your coefficients. You multiply all the coefficients by the grid spacing h. You multiply the ones at the boundary by 1 half, because the boundary basis functions are just half as much. And then you sum them all up, and then you get the integral over the domain. This is for finite differences, where the basis functions look like this. For Legendre polynomials, integration is even easier. Can you imagine why? Oh, wait, I'm not sure. I could be wrong. No, anyway, the integrals of the Legendre polynomials are known. I just thought, I mean, I'm lecturing here, I could be way off base here. I just thought that the integrals of all the Legendre polynomials except P0 would be 0. No, I'm not sure anymore because I'm standing here in front of you. Half of them vanish anyway, right? The odd ones must vanish. So if the integral vanishes, the coefficient just doesn't contribute. For the even ones, I'm not sure whether above and below the axis, whether they actually cancel out or not. I have a feeling like that, but difficult for me to think. Anyway, P0, the coefficient, is the most important one for that integral. And that also makes it very easy to integrate something, integrate functions. Okay, that concludes my lecture. Do you have questions? This was very theoretical compared to the first 2 weeks of this course, which was hands-on training and GitHub and installing or something. This is now a very different style. Yes?
You have shown us several different methods here, named. But here PLC belongs to which one?
It's finite differences, the second one. The PLC and finite differences, that belongs together. Okay, piecewise linear continuous. And if you have piecewise parabolic or something higher order, then you get higher order finite differences. And in the Einstein toolkit, the default these days is fourth order finite differencing, where you use third order parabola for interpolation. Okay, at the end of the course, I will want to know whether this is useful, whether this is too much detail, or whether this is much too fast. And if this was spread out over a month or two, whether you'd still be interested. Because I don't know whether you just want to get kind of a first sniff at solving PDEs, or whether you want to make that one of the main workhorses of your research. So I'm open to feedback. Yes?
So is that any different from the trapezoid? Was that exactly the trapezoid method?
Yes, yes, it is exactly the trapezoid method. Thank you. So there's only a finite number of methods, and you can derive each of these methods in different ways. And by making various different assumptions, you arrive at the same methods. That, of course, have been developed independently, discovered independently hundreds of years ago. OK. See you on Wednesday.